was it in operation at that
it
time?
It was in its initial operational stage,
really?
During the tests.
Yeah.
And it was due to come on stream, this is the back end of my tour at NORAD.
Yeah.
It was due to come on stream at about just after I left NORAD. And that has become fully operational, not an initial operational capability, but fully operational.
So this would be the only real capability that you would have to reply to the intelligence
that, is right.
that was being fed in.
This was the only defense against an incoming ICBM. But that ICBM had to be coming down on a path towards the Minuteman Field up in North Dakota because of the range of the Sprite and Spartan, which were the two relatively short-range missiles which were used to intercept.
Yeah.
They were the anti-ballistic missile.
Yeah. Let me interrupt again because what you're describing, of course, is a fabulous system, and I know you. It's not only one system, it's a great combination of systems. But thinking of yourself in a position where, as you would be from time to time, in command with the commander-in-chief away, and try and keep track of everything that's going on, trying to, shall we say, inform SAC, the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Canada, and all the other bits and pieces. I can see you with about three telephones in other hand. You
how? It was done through. Well, let me start again. We have been talking about all the detection systems, and if you like, the defensive systems. Now, all of that equipment, that high technology, was only as good as the communications.
Yeah.
System that was tying it all together.
Right.
Now, I haven't mentioned the communication system. It in itself was a revelation. There were about three or four ways of getting in and getting out.
Mm-hmm.
Primary systems of Cheyenne Mountain, that is the headquarters itself, the operations center. There was backup to make sure that we, even if there was even if missiles hit in the immediate area of Cheyenne Mountain, that it would still be able to communicate. The other aspect was rapidity, quick communications.
Yeah.
And the technician for communications in the ops room sat at a dais of his own. And he had 499 buttons on that board.
Oh, is this the fellow on the left?
That's the boy on the left.
The screen?
You look at the screen.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
And those communications literally were to all over, not only just NORAD, but other commands, and of course Washington and Ottawa. And he could bring up a conference call, literally by pushing five buttons all at the same time. And these were directly through to the ops room. Now, let's take, you were asking about the president. The button would go to Washington, and it would go into the main operations center in the National Operations Center in Washington. Or it would go to the airborne operations center, which the Americans have. That where the president or the vice would go and be available if Washington should get knocked out, be able to handle communications to direct the United States war effort, but do it from an airplane. Similarly, it would go into Ottawa. Now, I'll leave Ottawa for a moment because I want to come back and spend a little bit of time on Ottawa and a little bit further downstream. That I'll just simply say that the communications in Ottawa would then try to get in touch with the PM.
Yeah.
In Washington, it was bang. They had their own conference net in Washington, so a conference net would tie into a conference net, and you'd have, say, the chairman, chief of staff, the president, and perhaps the Secretary for Defense, who'd all come on the net in Washington, depending on where the people were and how they were organized at that particular time. But you know that the president is always within instantaneous communication of the officer in Washington. This is part of his job. There's always someone traveling with the president. Whenever you see the president, you find that there's somebody with a black bag who's not very far away from him. And that black bag is basically a communication system, so that if there's a panic, he can be literally stopped wherever he is, whether he's airborne, whether he's on a train, in a vehicle, or walking. Mm-hmm. And he is in immediate contact with the op center in Washington. It's the only delay is for long enough for the boy who's carrying the bag to answer the phone and hand it to the get the contact and hand it to the president, because it's immediately asked. He's the one who's asked for it. Well, when they come on, and during exercises, normally in an exercise in Washington, they have people who simulate these high-priced helps. There was one exercise where they tried to ring in high-priced help, and I happened to be on duty when it was necessary to talk to the president, who at that time was airborne. And I talked to somebody up in that airborne damn airplane who sure as hell wasn't any one of the normal military people who dub in or simulate to these people. I don't think it was a president, but I'm almost certain it was a vice president who was actually taking part in that exercise. Now, the Americans are very good that way. When they, say once a year, when they have one of these big military nationwide exercises, they do ring in all of the top brass. Even the president gets involved in the sense of being in the ops room in Washington and watching what's going on. They're very conscious of the responsibility they have.
Yeah.
And therefore, these are the things that they have to do to test the system. And if you like, train the president.
Yeah.
Because the responsibility he has, the responsibility he carries, when it's put to the test, there isn't going to be time for him to say, holy mackerel, now what should I do in a situation like this? He's got to be able to respond immediately, because he's going to have just a matter of a few minutes to make a decision, and not time to go back and say, well, I wish I'd read about that, or I wish I'd spent a little bit of time finding out about this, or what does that mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
You say so-and-so. Will you tell me? You'll have to explain that to me. I don't even know what that means, William. There's going to be time for that kind of education.
Well,
it's all got to be done beforehand.
Also, just to inject a little point here, you mentioned that when you contacted on an exercise Washington, and you would most likely try and get hold of the chairman of the chief of staff, the minister of defense, or the defense secretary, and shall we say the president or vice president, the exercise, one would assume, might show a missile headed towards Washington. Now, you've got to get these three people, presumably, to safety bloody quickly.
Yeah.
And if they're to carry on their conversation, you know, unless it's going to be interrupted.
Oh, yeah, by a bomb.
My God, the time is, it's, you know,
that's
get
right.
A plane, get the hell out of there.
The situation in Washington is a terribly complex one. And the Americans, that is, the chiefs of staff, and I suppose you'd call it their security, National Security Council.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, they have to make a decision as to how they're going to handle the crises that is obviously on the horizon or has occurred, but no shooting has started.
Yeah.
Because they are just as aware as everyone else that once the first missile goes, it's going to be a maximum of 20 minutes. And if it happens to be one of a submarine-launched missiles, they've even got less time.
Yeah.
So they themselves then have to decide on what posture they're going to take immediately. And I don't think it is possible to determine what that posture would be before the event. There would be too many other things that come into play. And I can just give you a couple of very simple ones without getting complicated at all. The president happens to be not in Washington. He happens to be way down south. He's on a visit. He's on a trip. The president could be out of the country. The president could be sick. He could be in bed with the flu. Something that would be, if you had a set pattern, it would just throw the whole damn thing out. So what you have to do is have a set of procedures which will respond in a general sense to the general situation, and then hone it to whatever the peculiarities of that particular situation require. My guess, and it is only a guess, is that if the situation was difficult enough, the command post would have been flushed. The command post would be airborne anyway. The command post would be, at the slightest sign of anything wrong, the airborne command post, national command post, would get airborne. My guess is that it would be normal to put the vice president up in that airplane, and so that if anything did happen in a hurry, that he would be ready to take over. In other words, he is the immediate backup. Now, if Washington, nothing happened, and even if there was an attack and Washington was not hit, then he wouldn't be required. But if Washington should get hit and communications lost with the president, then he would be the one to pick up all the responsibilities that go with the president's position. How that's written into their law or how they handle that, I don't know. Of course, I'm not privy, and never was privy to that sort of internal organization. Yeah. But obviously, they thought it through, and they're ready to respond. But I think that they keep themselves flexible up until that very last minute when the decision has to be made. But they all know that it could go any direction at any second, and they're all ready to respond with whatever the president says. This is the way we better play it.
Yeah.
He might even get airborne himself and say, no, I think it's important. I think this is this. Oh, let me again paint a scenario where he feels that the situation is obviously leading to war or such a grave risk that he himself had better get up into that airplane, where he's in communication with all his other responsibilities, not just military, everything else, with advisors, with a small but very carefully selected team of specialists and advisors who can advise him on how to handle his responsibilities, not only in the military sense, but every other way.
Yeah.
So, it's, and a lot will depend on the character of the individual, too, how he wants to handle it.
Would you have that sort of thing written into one of these exercise scenarios that we're talking about?
No, not at NORAD. No, not at NORAD. That would be written into the scenario for the command post in Washington.
Right, right.
And really, it was of no consequence to us. It was Washington's job to make sure the president was available. All we did was let Washington know. And then the president would be cut in to the line. Now, how that was done was of no consequence. All we had to do was have the communications to, when sync was ready, at a certain stage or a certain point in the exercise, the information which has been provided by all the various sensors has now been displayed. And time is running. The clock is just ticking off every bloody second. And the commander-in-chief of NORAD is finally up against the wall. He's got to talk to Washington and say, here is what's happening and here's what I think is going to happen.
Yeah.
Then he must pick up the phone. But when he's ready to talk, that phone's got to go straight through. Bang! It's just as if you had an office interphone. He's got to be able... And all he does is he as soon as he thinks he's ready... He's got staff around him, and one of the staff have already alerted to get the line open, and under a difficult situation, the line would be kept open between Washington and NORAD. And then as soon as I think he would then pick up and he would say, this is the Commander-in-Chief NORAD speaking. And by that time, he would know who would be on the line.
Yeah.
And he would say, here is my assessment of the situation. And then he would very rapidly, and in a matter of 30 seconds to a minute, he would give his assessment. He couldn't spend much more time than that. He wouldn't be able to elaborate. It had to be concise. It had to be clear. And then when he finished, he would say, any questions? Mm-hmm. And that is when someone like the president would say, well, what about so-and-so? And then Sink would have to answer that question like that. Then the conversation would not go on very long before the president or the chairman of the chiefs, whoever happened, depending on the level of the information to be passed out, would say, thank you very much. And then you would hear him say, all right, chairman, I think we had better do so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. And then you'd begin to hear some of the instructions which would flow as a result of the advice given by Signore.
But this, again, you would at this stage presumably be on a group
Hookup,
because SAC is wondering what to do.
SAC would always always cut into those conversations.
Yeah,
always, because SAC would be waiting for direction from the president as to what to do. And of course, SAC would have been brought up to a very high state of alert. Most of their bombers would have been airborne. The airborne alert would have been declared.
Yeah.
Now it's a question of what happens to the Minutemen. Are they fired? Or are they just held at readiness to go? Reg, there is 100,000 different scenarios. It never used to amaze me how those characters in the scenario shop could dream up so many different, diametrically opposed positions, which were viable and made sense and could happen and put you in a position. After I did my first exercise, I thought, oh boy, I've got this button, you know, this is great.
Yeah.
I know what the hell to do the next time they have an exercise. I'm not going to make that mistake again. Well, God, you'd only be into the next exercise about an hour, and all of a sudden you'd get that terrible creepy feeling that you're being led down the garden path by these rascals who write that scenario, and it isn't going to be anything like the last one, and sure as fate, another hour downstream, and you'd begin to say, my God, what do I do now? And you could, after during the very intense period of one of those exercises, I'm not exaggerating, the feeling, you get so wrapped up, and the whole of the command post would get so wrapped up, that, boy, by the time a decision was made, or if it happened, the exercise came to an immediate end, you were wringing wet.
You really were.
It never used to amaze me how very involved you got, because all of a sudden the enormous responsibility that was going with your decision kind of hit you. It didn't hit you there, it hit you immediately afterwards.
Yeah.
But you realized that as you were working and as you were trying to assimilate all the information that was being provided and the advice that was being given in a real pressure cooker, that when you picked up that phone, what they called the red phone, when you picked up that phone, which was a hotline right through to Washington, when you picked that phone up, bingo, you had to understand the situation, and you knew that what you were going to say was going to have an enormous impact on what happened next in this war.
Yeah.
It could have been a preemptive strike. It could be all kinds of things. So it is an enormous responsibility. I would think it's in the States, in terms of wartime, it's the Commander-in-Chief of NORAD, his responsibility is probably second only to that of the President himself. Because while all the other commanders, such as Commander SAC, have enormous responsibilities, they only act on an instruction from Washington.
Yeah.
Commander SAC doesn't make any decisions. That is of a major strategic nature himself. He knows what the options are, and he's ready for any option, but he waits till he's told, or again, giving weather conditions and whatever, and having listed, he might try to modify a direction, but he doesn't make a decision as such. Whereas the Commander-in-Chief of NORAD, when he advises Washington, what he tells Washington is the factor to determine what Washington does next. And it could be a standoff, it could be don't react. It could be fire everything, let it go, rip it. And you go right from those two extremes. And so his advice is absolutely the major factor in determining what the rest. Now, I'm talking now, again, in the sense of a major strategic situation of missiles. Yeah. I'm not talking what might be happening in Europe.
No, I can
such as
that.
Such
yeah.
as in NATO, armies fighting it out in a conventional sense or anything like that, but in a pre-nuclear
yeah.
war.
But you're also talking, and we are talking exercises, how should I put this? The exercises, if they last, as you say, from, shall we say, 1 to 2 to 3 days, this is all based on the assumption, naturally, that there is a certain amount of lead time into the crisis situation. In other words,
yes. Normally there's a scenario.
Yeah.
And the reason for a scenario build-up, intelligence build-up, is purely and simply to give all the players. And the players are in a command-wide exercise. That's all the commanders out in the field and the BMU stations and everything, the whole organization, all the detection systems, a chance to understand what is going on.
Yeah.
That there is a period of tension and a buildup.
Yeah.
They don't know what that's going to lead to.
Yeah.
But they do. It's done to bring everybody up, sort of, shall we say, up to speed. So.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you had another point you wanted to make.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't be an exercise, shall we say, that starts at 10 o'clock and it's all over at 20
after 10.
Oh,
yeah, we've had those, too. We've had those.
That
no, not that quick. No, not in 20 minutes. But we have had them last 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
Now, the kicker there is another point, talking about the organization right in NORAD itself. Either the sink, the commander-in-chief, or the deputy must always be in Colorado. Now, if that is in Colorado Springs.
Yeah.
If they are not, the chairman of chiefs of staff has to give them authority for both to be out of town at the same
yeah.
time. It does happen, and it has happened, but it's done with Washington being very aware of what has transpired. And there are occasions when it's necessary for both to be away for some special reason.
Yeah.
And the chief, the Washington, and a normal peacetime situation says, okay, that's fine, you know, that's no problem, because we don't expect war to break out in the next 4 hours or something
yeah.
like that. But if the situation was tricky, there would be things would be canceled. Well, both would go anyway, no matter what. Now, with one always there, the next thing is that the wherever that officer might be, could be home, might even be out in a golf course playing golf, could be in office downtown, could even be shopping, depending on the time of day of what day this sort of thing happened. But that's why the commander and the deputy commander and most of the other senior staff always carried radios, because that radio, and you actually carried it with you, didn't make any difference whether you went shopping, where the hell you would go to a show, whatever, you carried your bloody radio with you. Because as soon as there was an alert of any kind, then you were buzzed, and you always had a vehicle with you. Always had a vehicle. And it had full radio equipment in it, too. Because the first thing you did was you just hit the road, bang, and you went flat out. As a matter of fact, the commander-in-chief's car even had red warning lights on it. It was just like a police car.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you just took off. And you took off at a high rate of speed. You didn't worry about police. You just took
yeah.
off. Matter of fact, the police knew your vehicles. You're in your private cars. Were known by the police. And they even had the chief of police come and tell me I was parked downtown. And, you know, that sort of thing. Just joking.
Yeah.
Keeping tab on our cars. You would then drive at breakneck speed to get up to the mountain, up the windy road that goes up the side
yeah.
of the mountain, and then in the before the doors close.
Yes, and when they close.
Because
they
when
close.
That big door closes on the entrance into the mountain,
yeah.
that's it.
Yeah.
And, of course, it closes as soon as there is a chance of an impact anywhere near the mountain. Now, they leave it until they know the incoming speed, they know the time of impact.
Yeah.
So they leave that door closing until the last possible moment. So that as many of the staff who are not on duty, and this, of course, would apply particularly at nighttime when you've got minimum staff on,
mm-hmm.
can get in to the mountain before the door closes. Because once the door closes, that is it.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to get there. And It was very important that, and that meant being literally within about 15 minutes. I used to never try to get more than about 12 minutes away from the actual getting in that door.
Yeah.
And that meant driving, flat out. Always.
How many miles would that be?
From my house to the mountain, let me think, what was it? It was about 6 miles.
Yeah.
If I was on the other side of town, it was getting up close to 12 miles.
Yeah.
If I went to the Air University, which was outside 12 miles north of Colorado Springs, to play golf or to whatever, some ceremony, always made sure that that they knew that I was going to be literally out of bounds, so to speak, to get back in if there was a panic.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that didn't really make that much difference under normal peacetime conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had alerts. There were alerts called, the actual alerts. The Russians, we could detect every missile that was launched from the USSR. And when they were testing their SS-9s and so forth, the alarms would go off in NORAD headquarters, and we'd all be called immediately.
So you have had sort of not necessarily practice runs, but real runs.
Yes, yes. Knowing full well. Okay, let me back off on that. Not knowing full well. Suspecting that it was a test firing.
Yeah.
But we have had occasion. Well, there was one time when the USSR fired, I think it was 3 missiles in a row to the Pacific test range.
Yeah.
One right after another. And that got everybody a little excited because these were SS-9s. And when they were initially launched, we didn't know whether they were going to go into orbit and around the Earth, whether they were actually going to land in the test range, or what the hell was going to happen.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah.
So it was, that caused the panic button to be pushed, and everybody rushed in to find that they did land, and the Russians had closed that particular part of the Pacific for so-called test purposes, so the U.S. Navy had moved in, and it was only when we got word that they had actually alerted, and our space detection system hadn't picked up anything, so there was nothing in orbit, that it looked as if it had been just a normal test run, then we all relaxed and went home.
Yeah.
But the exercises were normally called at the quiet hour because that was what you wanted to test. You wanted to get people into the Cheyenne Mountain complex, and so it was normally done at nighttime. And I had 3 different phones in my home, the normal telephone, and then I had a special ops phone, which was used purely for operational matters. And then I had a red phone. So that, now let me give you the case of where, for whatever reason, it was impossible to get into the mountain before the door closed. The idea was that you could be briefed over the radio or over the ops phone as to what the situation was. Being present in the ops room made it easier. But it was possible for the ops staff to brief you, and if you knew the thing well enough, you could visualize what was actually happening, and you knew the questions to ask and so on. But you had to do it remotely. The idea there was that if that should ever happen, that you couldn't get into the ops room before the door closed, you could then get all the information needed for an initial decision and then pick up the red phone, which was in your house, and get right through to Washington and do your briefing remotely, explaining the situation as you went along. So the communication systems were, and all those phones, they all had to be tested. They had to be lead cable, fantastic price. Digging trenches up to the house to put this special cable in so that it wouldn't be subject to atmospherics. And the care and thought that went into that communication system, incredible.
You were happy with the backup to the backup to the backup yourself.
Oh, yeah, no question.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
But wouldn't you, again, we're talking this morning primarily about the exercises, that sort of thing. Would they not play a scenario or scenarios where things went wrong You know, you talk about yourself being out shopping or being at the theater or at a play. Yeah. All right. What about the scenario where you get the warning, all in good time and all that sort of thing, you race like hell, and bang, you have an accident, your car is overturned, and you're killed.
Yeah.
And maybe the same thing happens to your assistant, if it matter, or something goes wrong
with the phone. Well, the system was really fairly simple. There was the commander-in-chief, then the deputy commander-in-chief.
Hmm.
Then there was the commander of the United States Air Defense Command, who was co-located at Colorado Springs, actually out at Peterson Field.
Mm-hmm.
He was number three. Then number four was they had a pecking order of the generals in the headquarters. And normally the next one would be the senior ops man. Normally. Not necessarily, because, boy, the Americans played seniority, right up to here. And if the chief of intelligence happened to be the senior man, then he was the one who would then take over operational control because of his seniority. And then down until finally you got down to the duty brigadier general. There was always a BGEN on duty in the ops room.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, in the headquarters.
Yeah.
So that if anything happened, there was at least a brigadier general who was very au fait with the whole system, who would, in the final analysis, be the one who would brief whoever was still alive outside or had a radio and could talk. Now, all these people had radios, and therefore were in a position to be briefed over the radio.
Well, now, when you talk about radio, you mean radio communication.
Radio communication.
Yeah,
even a hand-carried one.
Yeah.
Those damn little sets which you could carry around with you. You'd even carry them on a little pouch on the pocket, on the belt.
Yeah.
Those things, in those days, cost $1,200 a piece. And I don't know what they would cost today, but it was indicative of the reliability that was demanded in those sets.
Yeah.
And, boy, if your set ever went unserviceable for whatever reason, normally because you had used it and forgotten to turn it off and you ran the battery down.
Oh, yeah.
You had to immediately let them know that you were unserviceable. And they would send by car immediately a replacement. You'd have a replacement radio in 20 minutes. So and they would take yours back any time of the day.
Yeah.
It would be that was the kind of way they were ready to respond.
Yeah.
They responded immediately to everything. They were ready almost for any eventuality. You got the impression there wasn't anything that hadn't been thought of.
Yeah. And this would include, again, thinking of exercises, acts of sabotage, assassination.
Oh, yes. All the whole.
That.
Yes. They didn't deliberately write people out. There was another backup. If NORAD should go out, the backup was then North Bay, because North Bay was underground. Now, North Bay didn't have anything like the information that was coming into NORAD.
Yeah.
Nothing like it. But it would at least have some information and could be the backup. And once or twice, they actually wrote it in such a way that NORAD did go out. Now, that was nothing more. The only reason for that was to exercise the backup of the backup headquarters. And I'm sorry, I said North Bay rather quickly there. We had another concept where, under certain conditions, a team would leave NORAD and would be a remote headquarters. We always wanted to put it into an airplane, but up to the time I left, there would be no authority. There was an outstanding requirement for an airplane, like the command post, the airborne command post. But it kind of got all wrapped up in the AWACS requirement, as opposed to being a straight command post.
Yeah.
And so nothing was ever done about providing NORAD with an airborne command post, as SAC has. No, SAC has an airborne command post.
But I thought NORAD had two.
No. It got wrapped up, as I say, in the AWACS thing, because then you would have an aircraft that would do the AWACS bit and would also be the airborne command post.
Mm-hmm.
But what would happen was that this small team would then go out to one of the regions and then would be there as a backup. But it was kind of a false concept. The regions were all above ground, with exception of North Bay. And they were the control of the air defense system for that particular region, mm-hmm. and likely would be targeted out. They were all above ground, and obvious as the nose on your face, and very likely would be targeted outright from the word go. And, of course, any backup or alternate headquarters team would be written off faster than the one actually in Colorado Springs in that bloody great big hole in the ground. Now, they reckoned that it would take two or three SS-9s to knock out the NORAD headquarters. Almost hitting one simultaneously, or one went on top of the other. That's how deep that damn thing was. Yeah. It was solid granite, and it would take a lot. The greatest thing that would happen would be the impact of the electromagnetism that would be created by the electromagnetic field created by explosions, and what that would do to communications.
Yeah.
But even again, they were ready for that. They had communications that went out underground, shielded communications for a long, long, long way away from from Colorado Springs, miles and miles. And then would come up above ground and would be the backup for that particular type of situation. So,
presumably, also these tunnels, if the mountain was hit with a couple, and if there were people still alive inside, as doubtless there would be, you could get out.
Yes,
that way too.
Yes,
yeah.
There were escape routes out of the mountain, but.
By that time.
By that time. What the hell?
Escape to what?
Escape to what? NORAD's job, it's an interesting point, though, that NORAD's job finished. NORAD is really a peacetime organization.
Yeah. Hang on just for a second.
That NORAD is a peacetime organization, and NORAD's function, primary function, is completed once there is an exchange of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And its sole remaining function then becomes one of providing an active air defense if a bomber attack should be a follow-up or a part of the initial attack on North America. Now, once that's done, and NORAD headquarters itself plays very little part in the actual air defense function. That is the responsibility of the regions and the regional commanders out in the field. They have the weapons to provide, they have the aircraft and the fighters and the weapons to do a defense, and NORAD cannot fight the air battle from NORAD headquarters. It's got to be fought right from the radars and from the regional command posts out spread around the country.
Yeah.
All that NORAD can do, and this also was exercised, is go through a period which is called reconstitution. In other words, there is something left after the initial major attack, and it is now a question of trying to recover whatever is left and put it back together again into a viable fighting organization. So it is a matter of bringing together what's left and then disposing it on, or at least dispersing it to whatever operational bases are left, and then having a look at it and say, well, here's where we are, and this is what we've got left, and we're now ready for another onslaught, or whatever it might be. But by the time you get that far downstream, the whole thing begins to lose any semblance of reality at all, because you've gone through a major nuclear exchange, and how the hell one could possibly read what would be left after that is... It was more a question of exercising the system that this might occur, and this sort of thing. We should therefore have the procedure set up that if it did occur, there was some action that could be taken, and the procedures were there.
It's something I think Herman Kahn coined the phrase, thinking the unthinkable.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it did. It was good. It did exercise. Where it did help, and this is from a peacetime morale point of view, it did bring the logistics people and the backup communications people into play. The normal exercise really only affected the operational staff, because it was a question of warning all the systems were operating, and it was a question of decisions to be made. When you went beyond that, then the logistics people got into the act, and you could crank in all sorts of things, like moving nuclear weapons around. Now, God damn it, get them moved quickly. We need backup. We're gonna leapfrog some airplanes up into Canada. Now, you better have you got? Are you ready for it? Have you got all the ground handling equipment and the spares and the refueling tenders? And so the logistics staff would all of a sudden be put under the gun to do some figuring in an awful hurry, look at where the stuff was, and was there enough there to support a forward deployment of aircraft? Yeah. If not, how long would it take before they could move stuff in? And where were they going to get the airplanes for? They'd have to get on to the transport command to get airplanes in, to move the stuff. And were the airplanes available? And so they would get very deeply involved in planning this sort of thing, which was good for them. Then they felt that they were part of the exercise.
In fact, it touched everybody.
Oh, yes.
Everybody in the entire...
Yes, and on a major, on a national exercise, not just a NORAD exercise, on a national exercise, it would involve all the other commands, too. We'd talk to the Navy, talk to the Air Logistics, Airlift Command.
Yeah.
You'd talk to TAC, because sometimes there was a question of where if... Let me give you an for instance. TAC has an awful lot of fighters in the United States, and if they don't happen to be deployed overseas when something like that should happen, then all of a sudden you've got an awful lot of fighters at your disposal, a hell of a lot. Now it's a question of getting them into the right position, and having them tie in to the air defense system and plugging them in, and in an emergency you could do that. The Navy have all kinds of bloody fighters physically located in the United States, part of their training system for their carriers. And when a carrier is in for a refit or something like that, boy, there are a hell of a lot of airplanes that are sitting on their airfields. Well, again, plug those in. Yeah. They become a part of NORAD, under NORAD's operational control for an air defense or for an attack.
Yeah.
So you have a hell of a lot of backup that gets thrown into the in if they are there and if they're available.
Yeah.
So that all becomes part of an exercise.
Yeah.
Grabbing hold of what's available. Talk to the various commands and what's available. How fast can you move them? Can you locate squadrons up in such and such? We know there's a stream coming down. An obvious stream coming down over the east. And how fast can you relocate squadrons and give them a chance of intercepting that stream before it got down too far into the heartland?
Yeah.
That kind of thing would go on. If there happened to be a carrier in Norfolk, and the normal fighter squadrons that would be on that carrier are on one of the U.S. Navy bases in the Norfolk area, I'd plug them in immediately, and they become a part of the air defense system. So there was a lot that could be done.
Yeah, I can imagine your head would be reeling after your first 3 weeks of the first...
Yeah. Well, the exercises, as I say, they were great. They were great fun. I used to enjoy the exercises because it, aside from the fact that it gave you confidence, which was number one, the most important thing for the commander of NORAD is that he's got to have confidence in himself.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't have confidence in himself and he goes into one of those, a real life situation, he could come apart at the seams. And all he's got to do is procrastinate for 5 minutes and the whole thing's lost.
Yeah.
He's got to be able to make a decision. And you could even see the staff sweating. I would try, and my sort of modus operandi was I would hold off my decision as long as I possibly could. And I'd be very aware of what the time factor was, because that's the one thing you become very aware of. How much time have you got left? And boy, that old clock up there is counting down, and they have one, time to impact as well.
Yeah.
Time to first impact, I'm sorry. So you can see exactly how much time you've got left before the first missile's going to hit.
Yeah.
I would leave it as long as I felt I could. And normally that was a lot longer than the staff liked to see. And you could see the staff beginning to squirm, literally, physically squirm, because you had not taken that initiative, you had not initiated the phone call to get everybody briefed. And then the great heave of relief, the great almost collapsing when it was done.
Yeah.
So, It was terribly important that confidence was absolutely vital, and the one way to build up confidence was to run through as many exercises as you could. And I made them put me through all. They had several exercises on tape, short exercises.
Yeah.
Which were speeded up. They were not real time. They were speeded up, so that you could compress into, say, 4 hours that which would take, say, a day or 2 days to occur. But you had to go through all the basic actions. And more important, you didn't have as much time to think because everything was compressed. Mm-hmm. And you could run. They would run those. They ran several of those for me, just for me. With the training staff or the exercise staff, who always loved it when everyone would go in and say, "Pull an exercise and let's get going," because this was their bread and butter. And I worked at it and worked at it until I became bloody confident. And so I used to look forward to the exercises because it was a mental challenge.
Yeah.
It really was. It was you against those bastards who had written that damn thing.
Yeah.
And they'd try and trick you, come up with a situation plausible, but which you hadn't thought, and you'd sit there, and as I said, a number of times I'd turn to the colonel in charge of the scenario group, and when it was got to that terrible critical point in an exercise, and you were over a barrel, and I used to turn and I'd say, "Colonel, you bastard." And he'd laugh like hell. I couldn't laugh because I still had to make a decision.
Well, now, did he, in the scenario, and we're just without the tape, so I'll have to solve after this question, would he have the answer on the tape?
No, not necessarily, because quite often they were ready to respond with whatever the decision or whatever was passed out. But they had a pretty good idea. They had what you might call the pink, if you were in staff college parlance.
Yeah.
They, having written a thing, would say, "No, this is what this is what should really come out of this," but not necessarily so. It wasn't all that cut and dried. There were things that perhaps sometimes they even didn't think of.
Yeah.
And which would change an outcome, and that wouldn't appear. It wouldn't be written into their scenario. And quite often this did happen. Their scenario kind of got off the rails because they'd forgotten something, and it was picked up by the commander or the deputy commander, and it changed the pace of things. Yeah. And they would then run scrambling, trying to figure out what the hell they were going to get over that one themselves. So it was a bit of tit for tat, but it was all excellent training.
Well, I think we'll have to end it right there.
Okay,
since we're just about off the tape.
Yeah. Okay.